This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Americans spend a lot of time on social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat, and these spaces often act as echo chambers. We surround ourselves with like-minded people who share similar political views. So what happens when we break out of those silos and expose ourselves to broader political opinions on social media? Does it really change our perspective? That's the question a team of sociologists set out to answer. They were led by Duke scholar Christopher Bale, who built a Twitter bot that exposed a group of users to political views that were in opposition to their own. Turns out, diversifying your feed may not be the answer to finding more common ground. Christopher Bale is a professor of sociology and public policy at Duke University and the lead author of the study and joins us now. Chris, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell me more about the question you were trying to answer.
Sure. So as you mentioned, you know, for some time now, a lot of people have speculated that social media is hardening our political views, allowing us to cloister ourselves in partisan echo chambers. And, you know, the implication of all that is that if we were able to somehow take ourselves out of those echo chambers, that we would become more moderate. So what my team wanted to do was to see if we could disrupt social media echo chambers and see if we could actually reduce political polarization.
How'd you do that?
So we built Twitter bots. And, you know, typically we think about bots as kind of, you know, a net negative, right? They spread misinformation. They sow discord. But there's increasing interest among us social scientists about trying to use bots to try to do some good, or at the very least to try to understand basic social processes, especially on social media. And so our bot each day retweeted 24 messages from elected officials, media organizations, advocacy groups, nonprofit organizations from the opposing political party in order to try to gently disrupt people's social media echo chambers.
And the people you're disrupting now, they're in on this, right? I mean, they've agreed to be part of your survey.
Well, they've agreed to do our survey, but importantly, they didn't know what the bot was going to tweet. We only told them that the bot was going to tweet 24 messages a day. And for the first few days of the study, the bot only retweeted pictures of nature landscapes in order to further mask the purpose of the study. We were worried that if we only asked people to join the study who were already open to the idea of listening to the other side, we might underestimate the effect of disrupting social media echo chambers.
And the other thing is, just given the algorithms, the way they work, particularly in Twitter, if you keep, you know, sort of sending one particular kind of message, you're going to start to skew where that message goes, right, and who receives it.
Exactly. And this is, you know, the phenomenon broadly referred to as filter bubbles, that there's some kind of algorithmic feature of the machines that, you know, are so pervasive in our lives now, and especially on a platform like Twitter, that sort the content that we read. And so to combat that as a kind of confounding factor in our study, we decided to do two things. One, we asked people to turn that feature off on Twitter. And we told them to do that because we told them we were going to offer them more money if they could answer questions about the content of our bot's tweets. So one thing we did is once a day, our bot tweeted a picture of an adorable animal. And
just once a day?
Just once a day. Cute cats saving the internet.
God.
Right.
Keep going.
Then at the end of that week, we deleted all the pictures of the animal, and then we asked people whether they could identify the animal. And so that's how we knew which people were paying attention. We were able to measure the effect size according to the amount of exposure that they had to our bot.
All right, so here we go. We are now taking opposing messages to people who with particular views, Democrats, Republicans, or liberals and progressives and conservatives, depending on how you look at it. And now they're receiving these messages that don't comport with their political ideology. What'd you find out?
So we had two expectations going in. We thought that on the one hand, like, you know, so many people suggest, that disrupting social media echo chambers would produce moderation because, you know, there's this idea out there that, you know, stereotypes thrive in the absence of exposure to an opposing group. But on the other hand, there's a mounting body of research that says that if you're exposed to something you don't like, it creates a kind of cognitive dissonance, and you begin to think of even more reasons why you don't like that thing. And then you're left in the end with more reasons to oppose the message than you might have had in the beginning. And through a process that sociologists and social psychologists often call motivated reasoning, we can then wind up with beliefs that are actually stronger. Our pre-existing beliefs can be stronger than they were before that type of exposure.
All right. So what did you find in your study?
So what we found is kind of interesting, also a little depressing. The first thing is nobody became more moderate. Democrats became very, very slightly more liberal. But conservatives, interestingly, became substantially more conservative. On the order of the overall shift in partisan identification over some years. And so it's a substantially large effect, and one that dovetails with increasing interest in what social scientists are calling asymmetric polarization.
All right. So, well, let's talk about what's going on there, why the small change in progressive-leaning people and the larger change in those who are conservative.
Sure. There's a few ideas floating around out there. One is that, and this comes out of my field, cultural sociology and also social psychology, that liberals and conservatives simply have different value systems. So the core tenets of a Republican or conservative narrative is tradition, resistance to change, being steadfast in one's belief, and so on. Conversely, the liberal narrative is embracing of diversity, actually thinks that, you know, encountering diverse views is a good thing. And so to some extent, you know, we believe those type of core aspects of liberal and conservative identities made conservatives more resistant to our bots. Another way to look at it is to look at how elected officials are voting. And it could be the case that people are taking cues from elected officials. And if we look at the last 30 or 40 years of data in the U.S. Senate and Congress, what we see is that Republican legislatures have taken increasingly conservative positions, and liberal or Democrat legislators have taken just a very small move to the left.
And some would argue a move to the right if you look at the Clinton administration,
yeah,
for instance. So that's interesting. I mean, to examine those two templates and then put your work against that. The other broader question of why you double down rather than open your mind, and again, you had these two competing hypotheses and theories. One is the more we're exposed to other theories, the more likely we are to open our mind. Another is that if we're assaulted by a theory that doesn't comport, it's a dissonance that forces us to hold more tightly. It seems to me that context might play a role in this. Whether or not we're in a room, a conference room, trying to solve a problem, and we have all sorts of ideas on the table, perhaps I would expect individuals to become open-minded. If I'm assaulted in the middle of my day with a variety of issues over which I have no control, I might just want to put my hands over my head and hide.
Absolutely. And, you know, the research that suggests intergroup contact, that is when members of opposing groups come into contact with each other, that prejudice can be reduced, it requires some essential conditions. One is that the conditions of that and context of that encounter be positive, and the effects seem to be strongest when people are cooperating to fix a problem, a shared dilemma. And so, you know, we could debate about whether Twitter, you know, affords the kind of, forum for mutual understanding that you know, so much social science would prefer. But I think most people would agree that at a minimum, it doesn't allow us to humanize each other. And as you say, may allow us to simply voice our anger.
Well, yeah, it's the very nature of social media to assault us or to provide us this information in moments when we can't do a thing about it. Mm. And it's completely out of context, right? Whatever else we're doing, we're not solving global warming. Mm. So most likely. And we're not about to abandon social media. So is there a way in which you can imagine social media becoming adjusted to, you know, relieve some of the anxiety that it produces without every kind of engaging in productive and more human discourse?
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, some people may read our study and conclude that they should just immediately leave social media, right? Go out and walk in the woods. You know, the problem with that is it's just not practical. Younger generations increasingly not only use social media in droves, but they also rely upon it for their news about politics and for, you know, discussing politics. And so the idea that we can somehow just completely abandon social media is, I think you're right, quite naive. I think equally naive is the idea that we can just simply disrupt social media echo chambers and fix everything. I don't think Republicans and Democrats are ready to have conversations about certain issues, for example, the Russia investigation. It's just too central to the core identity of each party. But it's interesting you mentioned climate change, because an issue like climate change, you know, though we may see our elected officials being, you know, divided about it, there's actually a surprising amount of consensus among Americans that climate change is an issue of common concern. So perhaps it's the case case that if we can identify issues where there's one of the few remaining issues where there's a real opportunity for bipartisan consensus, if we could disrupt social media echo chambers around those issues and allow people to listen to each other around issues where there's really a genuine possibility for compromise, maybe we could move the needle.
But you even think that given the platform, again, and sort of the thing I get stuck on is that I'm reading this message when I'm not really empowered to do anything mm-hmm. about it. Versus, being in a room with somebody I don't agree with, and we're both charged with coming up with a solution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And indeed, there's another interesting study that came out this week. In this study, a group of sociologists recruited a bunch of people to play a game on the internet, and that was to guess how much climate change was occurring. And what they did, which was kind of interesting, is they had either groups that were homogenous in terms of their, Republicans were the Republicans guessing about how much climate change there was going to be in 2 years, and Democrats and Democrats. And what they found is if they didn't identify people as Republicans or Democrats, both Democrats and Republicans would develop more accurate forecasts about climate change. On the other hand, when they put the party cues back in, they discovered just what we found, a lot more polarization.
Tantalizing research with some real prospects for reform. Good to talk with you. Christopher Bale, professor of sociology and public policy at Duke University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find links to his research at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, yeah, it's clear we're polarized and the discourse is less civilized, but we'll talk with one philosopher who thinks there's a way around that. An improvement could be on the way. We'll talk about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.